The following live presentation by Rabbi David Aaron is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
What we have here is two accounts of the creation of man, and they seem to be contradictory. All right? And traditional Judaism does not attribute that contradiction to different authors, right? But deals with it in other ways. One way it deals with it is what Rashi brings down, the commentary Rashi, that this is really referring to general and specific. The first story was only interested in getting you to generally know that man was created, right? To talk about creation and to talk about man as part of a creation. And the second story starts filling in all the details just how that exactly happened and where that happened. All right? Do you follow that? And that is the acceptable understanding of it, that the first account is in general. Okay, so that's the general understanding of it. Rashi brings down. All right? But in the meantime, I would like to compare these two and see if there's another theme that arises from it. So Leah's offering us one distinction. In the first account, what's mentioned is nothing vis-a-vis where man is. In the second account, we are told that he was placed in a garden. What we're going to explore is the writings of Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik was born in 1903 and died in 1993, only 2 years ago. And Rabbi Soloveitchik was the head of a very successful and very important institution called Yeshiva University, right, in New York. It's a university, and it's also a yeshiva. And Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote an essay called The Lonely Man of Faith, whereby, based on the discrepancies between these two accounts, he gives us an insight to two tendencies within the human being. Okay? And that what's really written in the Torah are certainly not different authors, but the Bible giving us, in fact, two completely different images of the human being, and they go in different directions, and yet it is still the one human being that exists within a kind of dialectic, exists within a certain dilemma. And that's the way it is, right? That's the way it is. And that dilemma is not going to be completely solved, but it's part of our life. It's part of our struggle. These are the two different sides of this one being, right? Two tendencies, all right? So before we go into it, right, let me just give you a little introduction outside. Rabbi Soloveitchik says that there are two Adams, so to speak. Adam 1 and Adam 2. Alright? Adam 1 and Adam 2 are very different, even though they're the same Adam. They are different in terms of their assignment. They're different in terms of their life objectives. They are different in terms of their interpersonal relationships. They're different in terms of their community and what they see community as and the meaning of community has for them. And they're different in terms of their relationship to God, what God inspires in them, what God invokes in them, and what the existence of God means to them. All right? And so, instead of you just reading it, I had two choices. I first thought what I'd do is simply tell you outside, orally, what he says inside. But he writes so beautifully that I just felt I would just miss so much. On the other hand, this is kind of straightforward reading. Right? I think some of this you could understand without me reading this with you. But as a community kind of thing, we'll do it together. And I think it would be unfair to Rav Soloveitchik, who is such a brilliant thinker and writes in such a eloquent, poetic way that really not only conveys the content, the philosophical point he's making, but I really felt a certain feeling from the way he wrote, and I didn't want you to miss that feeling. So let's read it together. Right? Call him over on the left-hand side. What is Adam?
This, This is English, right? This is not translated.
He wrote it in English. Yes, Rabbi Soloveitchik lived in America for a good part of his life. You know, he's an Orthodox rabbi, and there are many, many rabbis that got their rabbinical ordination from him. And you'll get a feel of who this rabbi was when you read this. It's interesting to note that what's beautiful about this piece, which we're not doing, is his introduction. All right? Because in his introduction, he talks about this being a very personal essay about himself. And you know, it's kind of rare to find rabbinical writings that speak from a personal point of view. Very often the writings are philosophical, conceptual, you know, ethical. But to really kind of share with us their inner struggle, there was not that much. Rav Kook, on the other hand, did write a lot in that way. And what's nice is to read Rav Soloveitchik and get a feel for the meaning of the loneliness of a person of faith. And, you know, in our discussions where people are talking about how they're calling their parents and what their parents are saying, you know, I felt this is especially apropos because there's a certain loneliness that people are starting to feel, a certain alienation, a certain estrangement from the world from whence they came, wondering, is that the world that I will go back to? Wondering what will be my relationship with my parents, and wondering whether everybody's going to look at me, is they're going to think that I'm just basically weird and strange, and that alienation of, if I do opt for the life of faith, what does that really mean? Does that leave me in a loneliness? And so Rav Soloveitchik deals with this, so I feel this is especially appropriate, because I think it really addresses our own real inner struggles. What is Adam the first out to achieve? What is the objective towards which he incessantly drives himself with enormous speed? The objective is self-evident, can be only one, namely, that which God put up before him, to be man, to be himself. That's the first thing you got to know. All we're trying to do in this world is to be ourselves. The question is, who is ourselves? Right? Because what Rav Soloveitchik is going to show us through the biblical text itself, that the human being has two selves. That this one being has a duality which is going off in different directions. And so, each of these, both Adam 1 and Adam 2, although their tendencies in the direction are so different, they both have essentially one objective. To be themselves. To be as I was created to be. And so, what is it about Adam 1? What was he created to be? He works with a simple equation introduced by the psalmist, who proclaimed the singularity and unique station of man in nature. For thou made him a little lower than the angels, and has crowned him with glory and honor. This is what it says in Tehillim, that God created man a little less than Elohim. I once brought this verse up. It can be translated as angels, it can be translated as God. Elohim is a name for God. And that the human being was created just a little less than Elohim. How so? How so? He is crowned with glory and honor. And he continues to say, which he quotes a little later, but I'll tell you right now, you have made him to have a dominion over the works of thy hands, you have put all things under his feet. What does that verse in Tehillim parallel? The creation story. God said, have dominion over the world, capture your environment. Right? That's what it says, correct? That's the assignment of Adam 1. To capture, to subdue, power, control your environment, harness the elements, the natural forces, and climb the ladder in terms of being a being which has a crown, a majestic position in the universe, king of the universe, by virtue of such control and such sovereignty over the natural forces. Got it? That is what the first man, or that is what Adam 1 can't help but want to do. Adam 1 is charging forward in this world, because he's going to get on top of those forces and control. And he's seeking to become empowered by nature. Adam 1 looks at the universe and sees a huge tool chest. You know? And he sees in it the possibility to build, to create, to develop, to conquer. And that is what he's created to do. And so, God has made him a little less than himself because Adam, one, is created in the image of a creator, in the image of a ruler, in the image of the source of all power. And he can't help but be like that. Alright? And what is it that he's after? He's after a status called dignity. Dignity. What is dignity? So the psalmist tells us what dignity is. You have crowned him a little less than the divine. You have crowned him with glory. You have crowned him with kavod, which is dignity. How so? So the psalm says so. How so? By putting the world under his feet, under his dominion. And one achieves a status of dignity, of what's called kavod, by being in control of the world. And when I say control, not in an irresponsible way, because that's not dignified, right? That's cruel, that's criminal. We're talking about a dignified human being who can walk with honor. An honorable human being is a human being who is in control of the world and is a distinguished being, right? He's not like all the other animals, right? He's not like all the animals. So let's read on. Man is an honorable being. In other words, man is a dignified being. And to be human means to live with dignity. And this is a very, very serious idea. That you have been created to achieve dignity. And now we have to define what dignity is. However, this equation of two unknown qualities requires further elaboration. We must be ready to answer the question, what is dignity and how can it be realized? Right? Are you a dignified human being? The answer we find again in the words of the psalmist, who addressed himself to the obvious question, who termed man not only an honorable, but also a glorious being, spelling out the essence of glory in unmistakable terms. Thou hast made him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet. Right? God entrusted man with the works of God's hands. And this is a phenomenal, empowering position. God has made man into a little king, so to speak, of the world. And man has to do it responsibly. Because he realizes it's not his world, it's God's world. And therefore he's responsible to God, but nonetheless, it's a responsible position of power. And what is it? He says, in other words, dignity was equated by the psalmist with man's capability of dominating his environment and exercising control over it. That's a dignified human being. He contrasts that to a brute. What is a brute? Right? A brute is a helpless animal-like creature. Right? When you're helpless, when you're victimized by circumstances, when you're victimized by your environment, you're not a dignified human being, you're a primitive being, right? And primitive man was frightened of lightning, and primitive man was frightened of thunder, and primitive man... But that's primitive, that's undignified human being. Dignified human being is in control as much as possible, and cannot help but try and be more and more and more in control of his environment, and that will distinguish him, give him a distinguished position vis-a-vis nature. And so man acquires dignity through glory, through his majestic posture vis-a-vis his environment. Now I want to warn you, I have edited, who might edit Rav Soloveitchik, but what I did is, this looks like a running thing, but I actually cut out pieces which were the key paragraphs. Alright? So the first man, or so to speak, Adam 1, has an assignment. The assignment is to be majestic. The assignment is to become a dignified being. The assignment is to distinguish yourself from environment by being able to control the environment as best as possible. And that can only be done with a sense of responsibility to God. Right? You have to do that responsibly. So when people get nervous, environmentalists look and say, oh yeah, right, that's exactly what man is doing. He's dumping all this pollution into the river and he's doing that. That is not dignified. And he'll explain even more. There's something else that gives you dignity. Right? Hence, Adam the first is aggressive, bold, and victory-minded. It's a win-win man. Okay? That's what Adam 1 is. His motto is success, triumph over the cosmic forces. He is being asked to fill the world. He's asked to conquer the world. And what does that mean? To conquer nature? The Ramban says he should be drilling into the ground. He should be mining the ground. He should take the minerals out of the ground and build things out of it. He should be filling the earth. He should be civilizing the earth. We have a responsibility to, in fact, go to uncivilized areas, go to places and build and build and build. And make this into a kingdom. A kingdom that God shares with the human being. He is that powerful. And his motto is success, triumph of the cosmic forces. He engages in creative work trying to imitate his maker. And that's how I'm like God. I'm like God because I too am a creator. I'm like God because I too have a rulership position. I'm like God because I too am in control. I too have rulership. Alright? And that is dignity to the human being to be able to do that. And so Rav Soloveitchik explains that when man builds hospitals fighting diseases, when man builds airplanes being able to move from one area to the other area within a matter of moments, that brings more and more dignity to the human being because we are on top of the natural forces. The natural forces are becoming less and less in the way of we doing what we want to do. Remember, we have to do it responsibly, but nonetheless, we are conquering the limitations of nature. Isn't that really the theme of technology? The theme of technology is how to do it faster and how to do it smaller. Time and space is becoming less and less an obstacle to my success. And that's an experience of control. God created space, God created time, and I, God-like, am seeking to at least be in control of time. In control of space. I too transcend the limitation of time and space, because once upon a time, for me to get from Israel to the United States, would have taken me, I don't know, maybe weeks, right? Especially if you know how to walk on water. But now that I have a plane, now they're coming up with this whole thing that what they're going to do is shoot you in the air, and you're going to hover in mid-space, you'll wait for the earth to turn, and then you'll land. It's unbelievable what they're coming up with, right? And when you think in terms of what really is technology, it's smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, right? Everything is smaller. Before you know it, they're going to have this watch that has a washing machine in it, a dryer in it. You know, it's because everything is smaller and smaller and smaller. That's the theme of technology. To conquer the limitations of nature. To conquer the limitations of time and space. And this brings dignity to the human being. Because the human being is in a very distinguished place. A place whereby he feels just a little less. But just a little less. Than God. And this is what we have been mandated to do, and therefore man cannot help himself technologically, scientifically. He cannot help himself. And this man creates worlds. He creates a mathematical, scientific world. He creates equations with abstract concepts which are in brilliant correlate to this world, enable us to know how to navigate this world. And that's the scientist. That's Albert Einstein. That is the success of being created in the image of God, created in the image of creator, being a creator of worlds. And now he has created cyberspace, a whole world of computers and communication. It's absolutely remarkable. And this is what we can't help but want to do, because this is part of who we are. One second. Let me fill in Adam 1, then you can ask all the questions you want about Adam 1. There's another side to Adam 1. He's not only your classic scientist, right? Technical-minded, practical-minded, right? Adam 1, what does Adam 1 ask? How? He's not interested in the why. Adam 1 wants to know, how does this world work? Because if I can duplicate it, if I can replicate it, I can control it, right? It's remarkable. I remember when my brother-in-law, they had problems giving birth. They had, two kids. And then for some reason, when they were trying to have a third kid, they had like three miscarriages. And finally, the doctor said, the only way that we'll be able to hold on to this next baby is you're going to have to lie in bed for the next 9 months in the hospital. So fine. So my My sister-in-law is lying in the hospital for months and months and months. It gets to the seventh month, and a doctor comes and says, let me check you. She says, okay, a doctor was just here 2 minutes ago. He says, let me check you anyways. He checks her. He says, these babies are going to be born. She had twins. Babies are going to be born in this next 5 minutes. Rush her into the operating room. You know, and what was going on was just tension for months. The babies were in this machinery, that machinery, the amount of people, this and that. And they saved these two babies, right, who were born very prematurely. And it was quite remarkable how the human being is able to replicate the natural workings of a woman's womb through all the technology. Now, we can't do it as well. It takes round-the-clock time. It takes, you know, tremendous resources, finances. But mankind can do it, and we're doing it better and better and better. And this is dignified. You're not a primitive being that is somewhat a victim of circumstances. But you have the ability to be on top of it more and more. But there's another side, beside the scientific, practical, technological side of the human being. There's the aesthetic side. And this is also belonging to Adam 1. Let's read. Adam the First is not only a creative theoretician, so to speak, creating worlds, conceptual worlds, which are very accurately describing this world. He is also a creative aesthetic. He fashions ideas with his mind and beauty with his heart. He enjoys both his intellectual and his aesthetic creativity and takes pride in it. He also displays creativity in the world of the norm. He legislates for himself norms and laws. And why? Because a dignified existence is an orderly one. Anarchy and dignity are mutually exclusive. In other words, he has pointed out, he has proven to us from the Psalms that the human being has been crowned with dignity, with honor, with what's called kavod. And that starts with his ability to dominion, to have dominion over the earth that's being placed underneath him, right? And part of that is not only scientific and technological, but part of that is also creativity. I make my world beautiful, right? It's also order in terms of there's the way you do things. When you're eating, don't forget to have the little pinky up in the air when you're sipping your tea, because that's etiquette. You know, you walk into someone's house, they think, oh, how undignified. Did you see the way he drank his tea? You know, yes, mankind has the right, and cannot help but create these certain norms, certain laws that create harmony and order and beauty. Because ugliness and dirtiness and anarchy is primitive. And it's not dignified. You walk into someone's house and it's an absolute mess. Right? Dirt and filth and this and that and there's anarchy in the house. You feel this is an undignified home. Correct? Do you hear this? And therefore, what Rav Soloveitchik is telling us is that this Adam One, whose mandate is to become kingly, majestic, dignified, is expressed through technology, through science, through art, through politics, because we have been assigned to become dignified human beings, distinguished beings, distinguished from the animal, helpless world that cannot do this. Let's read on. Adam the First is always in the step. Whether engaged in an intellectual or an ethical performance, his conscience is energized not by the idea of the good, but by that of the beautiful. His mind is questing not for the true, but for the pleasant and functional, which are rooted in the aesthetical, not the, ethical sphere. Now this, he says, and we'll talk about this when we get to the sin of the first man, that this Adam One is motivated by beauty and order and power. He's not interested in good. He's not interested in ethical. Right? That's not his considerations. Right? His considerations is beauty and practical. When he looks at the world, he thinks, how can it be useful to me? How can it be useful to me to achieve a dignified, majestic position? With understanding that I cannot destroy it. because that wouldn't be dignified to destroy it either. In doing all this, Adam the First is trying to carry out the mandate entrusted to him by his Maker, last paragraph, who at dawn of the sixth mysterious day of creation addressed himself to man and summoned him to fill the earth and subdue it. It is God who decreed that the story of Adam the First be this great saga of freedom of man's slave, who gradually transforms himself into man-master. Okay, let's hear some questions about Adam 1. Yes, Heather?
I'm having a hard time seeing all this in these few sentences.
Well, he's not seeing it in these few sentences. He's seeing it in the entirety of Torah, in the entirety of Halacha, recognizing that in Judaism, to achieve dignity is a very prime concern that makes you different than an animal. And therefore, what Rav Soloveitchik is teaching us over here, that when the remember, we talked about it, there's the written Torah and there's the oral Torah. And everything that Judaism believes in is written in the Torah either implicitly or explicitly. And when you have a broad sense of the entirety of Torah, when you read these verses, right, then you know what these verses mean, right? You know what it means when it says, and God put man into the world and commanded him to subdue it, which means to harness its elements, to fill it, which means to civilize it. Rav Soloveitchik doesn't say this. The Ramban said this. It's a common knowledge that that's what it means. What Rav Soloveitchik is asking is what are the total ramifications of it? And when you realize, when you look at the Tehillim Psalms, and you realize that dominion, the Psalms tell you, is equated to kavod, so you know that the Psalms is giving a commentary on Adam 1. Psalms is saying that you crown man with dignity. How so? By commanding him to be in that majestic position in the world. Therefore, I think Rav Soloveitchik's interpretation is not such a big interpretation in terms of the fact that if you look at all the sources and you understand Torah in its totality and you look at mankind, right? Then you realize this is the drive of the human being, and it is, in fact, it is congruent with what the Torah said, that Adam was created in the image of. Adam is created in the image of a creator, in the image of a ruler, right? In an image of an organizer, and that is what he aspires to be. And that's okay, right? And that's okay. And what is that? That is reflecting dignity, honor, and glory. And that is what we aspire to. Whether we know why we're aspiring it to not, whether we know that we were created with this innately mandated within us, the human being cannot help but seek to the farthest reaches of the universe, to fly to the moon, to see how they can deal with weather, to see how they can struggle with natural disasters. That's just the way we are, and that's fine, right? But that's only one half of the human kind. And that's the half that I think many people are bringing up in terms of when they're talking to the parents. Because very often, the parents are coming from the Adam 1 position. The Adam 1 position is, what are you doing sitting learning religion? What is practically going to come out of it, right? What are you learning technically to be able to do? How does this serve to better your position in this environment, in this world? How are you going to get a job by spending all this time there? Right? Not to mention that I've seen some of these Orthodox Jews and they look really dirty and slimy. Now they won't say that maybe, but I've heard some people say that. Right? I've heard some people say, I can't believe my kid wants to do that. I mean, my home is full of art and music. My home is so full of social functions. And I was once walking in Mea Shearim, and I was just astounded how simple it was, how plain it was, how aesthetically unpleasing it was. I was once in a home of one of those zealous, ultra-Orthodox Jews. They didn't have pictures on the walls. It was the kids all over the place, right? And unfortunately, if they saw that, that's really unfortunate, because then those people who are living an undignified life under the heading of Orthodox Judaism, right, are unfortunately damaging the ideal of what Orthodox Judaism is really aspiring to. But we're talking about, people with their you know, their prejudices and their experiences and their limited experiences. And it makes sense. It really makes sense. You're sitting there learning the Bible. How will that enable you to battle the environment? How will that enable you to pay the bills? How will that enable you to, you know? And that's a very good question. And it's a very valid question. Because we all have Adam 1 inside of us. Right? And therefore, what we need to know is Adam 2. The other side of ourselves. The other side of ourselves. Because there's a side of ourselves that's looking for a dignified, distinguished position in the universe. But there's another side of ourselves that is not fulfilled by this dignified position. I'm a success. I am really successful. I have conquered. Everybody knows me. It's wonderful. And yet, for some reason, I'm not fulfilled. And so what is it that Adam, too, struggles with? Adam the second.
I like that. Adam the second.
Okay, Adam the second is like Adam the first, also intrigued by the cosmos. Intellectual curiosity drives them both to confront courageously the mysterium magnum of being. But when Adam 1 looks at the universe, what comes to his mind? What does it inspire him? It inspires him with a sense of what a tool chest. What I could do. If I could harness this power. If I could get fire. If I could get rain. If I could... What I could do. How godly I could be. How creative I could be. Right? So when he looks at the universe, Adam 1, in a scientific way, he can't help but simply ask, how can I replicate this? How does this work so I can control this? And how can I understand its dynamics so I can elevate myself and be on top of it? But Adam 2, when he looks at the world, and he's also struck by its mystery, he says, why? Why? What is all this for? What is this all about? What's the meaning of this? What's the purpose of this? He's not asking how does it work. He wants to know why does it work at all? And what am I doing here? Adam 1 knows what he's doing here. I'm here to conquer it. I'm here to climb the ladder. I'm here to establish a majestic position, a dignified position. Adam 2 is just in such awe. And he cannot figure out, what am I and who am I? And so, however, while the cosmos provokes Adam the first to quest for power and control, thus making him ask the functional how, Adam the second responds to the call of the cosmos by engaging in a different kind of cognitive gesture. He does not ask a single functional question. Instead, his inquiry is of a metaphysical nature, a threefold one. He wants to know, why is it, what is it, and who is it? And go explain that to your friends who are still in the Adam 1 mode. And don't, or are not ready to, acknowledge the Adam 2 mode. Because you're sitting there and they say, what are you talking about? You know, I want to know what I'm living for. I want to know the meaning of my existence. I want to know the value of my existence. And they and people look at you like, get a job! Get a job! That's it! And you say, I don't care if I have a job. It won't satisfy me completely. It might satisfy my desire to be creative. But there's something else inside me that I'm struggling with. And what is that? That's the breath of God that he blew into me. The first man was created in the image of a creator, and he cannot help but strive to be a creator. Adam 2 is struggling with that breath of godliness within them. Adam 2 is struggling with this intuitive, mysterious, and ridiculous sense that I am unique, and I am valuable, and I am meaningful, regardless of what I do. I am. And I am does not equate to I work. I work. Adam 1 fulfills his mandate by working, by producing. But Adam 1 is dealing with the ontological. Adam 1 is dealing with the very meaning and value of my being, regardless of what I do. And that is an amazing thing. He wants to know, why is it? What is it? Who is it? He's asking for essence. He's not asking for productivity. In a word, Adam the second explores not the scientific abstract universe, but the irresistible, fascinating, qualitative world where he establishes an intimate relationship with God. This yearning to connect with the source of all of this. Right? Now, Adam was not interested in connecting with any source, nothing. He just wants to win. He wants to control. He wants to be in power. But Adam 1, when he's lying in his bed, and all has been said and done, creeps in his Adam 2 side, starts to ask all those existential questions. And some people who have not yet experienced their Adam 2 side think you're crazy. They can't understand why you're wasting your time with all this. And so, there's something inside me that seeks this intimate connection with my source. Why? Because my source blew an aspect of himself within me, and I am existentially connected to this being. And until I uncover that, until I can live with that, I am not fulfilled. Even though I've got a fantastic job, making a lot of money, very much in control, a lot of power, but still for some reason feeling so disconnected. The biblical metaphor referring to God breathing life into Adam alludes to the actual preoccupation of the latter with God. What does it mean for us experientially that God has blown into us the breath of life? It means I'm preoccupied with this breath. I'm preoccupied from the inside of my inside with this existential feeling of ultimateness in me. And that's ridiculous. Right? I look at the world as so great, and I realize, what am I? Nothing. I'm really nothing, yet something inside tells me I'm something. What is that something inside tells me I'm something? Even at the lowest moments of my greatest defeats, am I still something? Am I still something? For some reason I believe I am, or I should be, regardless of my accomplishments. And so, let's start again over here. The biblical metaphor referring to God breathing life into Adam alludes to the actual preoccupation of the latter with God, to his genuine living experience of God rather than to some divine potential or endowment in Adam symbolized by the Mezzo Dei, which is what? First, Adam won. He senses power. He senses that he's been endowed with power, with a mandate to conquer. Right? But Adam too has this living experience of God. Not just a sense of a powerful being, but a sense of some kind of connectedness to an allness, to an eternity. Adam the second lives in close union with God. Adam the first, God, you might even say, doesn't matter if I believe in God, so what? You know, that's the great thing. You know, you can ask people, do you believe in God? Say, yeah, but so what? So what? For Adam 1? That might be enough. Because so what, if I believe in God or not? Do I need to believe in God to become ruler? Do I need to believe in God to become a scientist? Do I need to believe in God to become an artist? No. But I need to believe in God in order to satiate and to confirm this magical, mystical, ontological, existential sense that I am meaningful, regardless of what I do. And thirsting to be acknowledged, not for only what I do, but for who I am, regardless of what I do. I have this crazy, crazy expectation that someone should love me, whether I'm a winner or a loser. Why? Why? And it's generally, Soloveitchik talks about it, it's generally in defeat where you begin to discover the Adam won inside you. Because you're defeated. You lost. You failed. You lost all your property. Everything went bankrupt. They took away your home. They took away your car. Nobody's talking to you anymore. And yet something inside you says, but I'm still valuable. I'm still important. There is real worth. There is real legitimacy to my existence. Why? Why? Because there is a breath of the divine inside of me. And I have to tell you a story that hit me so strong. This is somebody I know who is he's probably a billionaire at this point. And he is so mighty, and he is so powerful, and he is so successful, with buildings named after him, you know. And everybody wants time with this man. He owns a private plane, flies the world, meeting everybody you could imagine you ever could want to meet, maybe. He's having meetings. When he was in Israel, he was meeting. I was granted a meeting with this man, right? I met him. But after that, he tells me, I got to run. I've got to meet with Peres. And then after that, I'm going to see Rabin. I thought, oh, isn't that interesting? You know, that is really very interesting. So I'm walking to the cab. And we were having a little conversation. I turned to him, I said, Mr. So-and-so, wow, what an exciting life you must have. You know, you're flying in your personal jet all over the world. How do you feel? He said, I feel lonely. I was shocked. I really wasn't expecting that. I wasn't asking it, you know, to challenge him. I was just interested. I was pretty awestruck at the moment. The Adam One in me was so impressed with this man. Right? But a distinguished human being. And yet when I asked him, and how do you feel? He said, I feel very lonely. Very lonely. Now listen, he's married, he's got kids. He feels very lonely. So I turned to him in shock. And he said, you know what, Rabbi? I know that if I were to lose all of this, nobody would even look at me. What a horrible, horrible thing to know. Nobody would even look at me. It's because of my power, it's because of my accomplishments, it's because of my, you know, my great intelligence and all the money I have that people are so anxious to see me. But if I were to lose that, would they want to see me just to see me? Would they want to be next to me just to be next to me? Because everybody is interested in me and what they're going to get out of me. And they see me in the same utilitarian way that I, Adam One, sees everything. How can I use it to further advance my position as a majestic being? But that's only one side. Because there's another side of me, which is this existential I-ness. Regardless of what I do, who I am. And therefore, Adam the Second lives in close union with God. His existential I experience is interwoven in the awareness of communing with the great self, whose footprints he discovers along the many torturous paths of creation. On the torturous paths of creation. As he's working his way up the ranks to acclaim or to claim his majestic position, there's this other side of him who seeks to commune with the great self, the I, which experiences value in relationship to this great self, because there's a spark of that great self in me. And that's, you know, that's such a childish way of being, but that's the way we are. It's so wonderful, you know. I'm looking at my kids growing up, and you laugh, and you hug them, and they don't know what they did, you know. Do you hug your baby because he did something? Right? You say, that was very good. You burped. I'm impressed. You are overcoming nature. And that is very good. You know? No, you hug your kid because he is. And just for the very isness of this being. The human being is looking for a hug. The human being is looking for acknowledgement. But in two ways. The human being is looking to be acknowledged as a dignified being by virtue of the fact that I have succeeded, I have triumphed over nature, I am in control, I am powerful, I am distinguished, and I am dignified. Yet the human being also is looking for acknowledgement, not only for what I succeed and accomplish, but for what I am. And I need to get in touch with my I am-ness. And I want to be evaluated for being, not only for working. And this, by the way, is what Shabbos is all about. Shabbos is the time for your Adam 2 to come out. All week long, fine, you're allowing the Adam 1 inside you, the technical, creative Adam, to evolve, to progress. But on Shabbos, Shabbos is such an unproductive, functionally ridiculous day where people sit and sing and go explain it to some of your friends and your family. What did you do? We sat in a dark room singing songs to go over and over and over again. Sometimes a half an hour. And what exactly did you gain? What exactly did you accomplish? I accomplished the excitement of my existential value. That in order to be, I don't always have to do. In order to sense value, it's not only via the work and the accomplishments. It's the being together. I invite you to my house for Shabbos. You say, what exactly will we discuss? What exactly will we accomplish? Is this a business meeting? No, we're just going to sit and sing songs. It's very hard for modern man to celebrate Shabbat. I've had people who told me that they went crazy for the first Shabbat at Israelite. They couldn't take it, just sitting there and singing and talking. And come on, let's do something. Let's accomplish something. And it's very hard for modern man to be able, because modern man is not addressing the Adam 2 and lives with this constant security that if I'm not working, if I'm not accomplishing, if I'm not conquering, if I'm not being triumphed, then I'm not worth anything. And no one will acknowledge me. And that is the tragedy of being just Adam 1. Let's go on, and you can ask a few more questions in a second. While Adam the first wants to reclaim himself from a closed-in, non-reflective, natural existence by setting himself up as a dignified, majestic being capable of ruling his environment, that's Adam 1. Adam the second sees his separateness from nature and his existential uniqueness, not in dignity or majesty, but in something else. There is, in his opinion, another mode of existence through which man can find his own self, namely the redemptive. Adam 1 is looking for dignity, and Adam 2 is looking for redemption. What is redemption? Which is not necessarily identical with dignified. Quite often an existence might be replete with dignity and mastery and yet remain unredeemed. Redemption is an existential problem. Dignity is a functional problem. In order to delineate more sharply the contours of Adam II, who rejected dignity as the sole objective of human questing, let us add the following observation. Dignity is a social and behavioral category. Dignity, you need somebody else there to say you're dignified. Dignity is something you do for everybody else. It's a social behavior, right? If nobody else sees you doing it. Rav Soloveitchik says dignity is linked to fame. The more famous a person is, the more dignified they feel. And everyone else thinks they're very dignified because they're famous. So dignity is a social behavioral category, expressing not an intrinsic existential quality, but a technique of living. Now somebody asked me the other day, why do you think your education was like that? Remember I shared with you my education and how really I was shocked because it wasn't addressing the why, what for questions. It was math, it was biology, it was physics, but nothing that dealt with how do you become a good person? How do you find meaning in your life? Because basically the educational system is based on the Adam 1 interests, right? It's all around the Adam 1 interest. It's not built around the Adam 2 interest, all right? Because the Adam 2 interest is not looking for just a technique of living. a way of impressing society. Everybody would say to me, oh, you're a success, you're going to be a doctor, a lawyer, an accountant, you can get into school, you'll be wonderful. You'll know how to do it better than a lot of other people know how to do it. I mean, why is it that when I would go to sleep, I would just sit there and feel like I'm a failure? And all my successes, with all my high marks, and with all everybody saying how great a student I am, and how accomplished I'm going to be, why did I still feel inside that sadness, that emptiness, that yearning? What was missing then? And the more they would say that to me, the more the Adam 2 in me felt so defeated, right? Because the Adam 2 in me says, I want you to love me because I am. And that's it. And so, the know-how of commanding respect and attention of the other fellow, a capacity to make one's presence felt, that's all Adam 1. But that's not intrinsic existential quality. That's what I do. In Hebrew, the noun kavod, dignity, the noun kovet, weight, gravitas, stem from the same root. The man of dignity is a weighty person. I'm looking for weight. You know, a person with dignity walks in the room, he carries a certain weight with him. Right? The man of dignity, weighty person. The person who surrounds him feels his impact. Hence, dignity is measured not by the inner worth of the in-depth personality, but by the accomplishments of the surface personality. Right? The educational system generally is working on developing your surface personality. And this is, by the way, not a critique. Because that's exactly what you'd be mandated. That's Adam 1's mandate. But Adam 2's mandate is to deal with your existential. To deal with that breath of God within you. To deal with the meaning of yourself, not in terms of others, in terms of what you did for them, and what you're able to do, but simply who you are. The visible, perceptible public image of the personality is fraught with majesty and dignity. Adam the First is never alone. And that's why Adam the First is created, man and woman, at the very same moment, because he's not alone. Because functionally, man is not alone. Okay? Because by definition, to be in a majestic position, in a dignified position, you have to have people around you. And that's how it works. So therefore, Adam 1 was created, so to speak, with a partner. Adam the First is never alone. Man in solitude has no opportunity to display his dignity and majesty, since both are behavioral social traits. Adam the First was not left alone even on the day of creation. He emerged into the world together with Eve, and God addressed himself to both of them as inseparable members of one community. So let's hear some questions on Adam 2 a little bit. We haven't fully exhausted the meaning of Adam 2, but in the next 15 minutes we will. In other words, we have two objectives that the human being yearns for. Dignity and redemption. Right? Dignity is connected to my surface personality. Redemption is my inside of my inside. Right? Dignity is accomplished through the how, by being successful technically, aesthetically, organizationally, and that brings dignity to me, and I am mandated, I am assigned to achieve that. But there's something else I'm assigned to do. Right? I'm assigned to grapple with my existential, my inner meaning, my value in terms of being. And when I get that, I'll feel redeemed. Because what is redemption? And this needs further clarification. What I'm going to share with you is even not enough. Redemption, Rav Soloveitchik explains, in Judaism means a sense of legitimacy, adequacy, worthiness of being, regardless of what I do. And why would I have that? Why would I even expect that? That itself is amazing. Not even expect that. Because the breath of the ultimate worthy, the ultimate absolute reality, the divine, is within me. And because I naturally commune with this divine, because I share with this divine life force, He has shared with me life force. He has shared with me an aspect of his being. And that's called my soul. And functionally, if you tell your friends I'm learning about my soul, what are you talking about? Right? If that's an Adam 1 person, that's what they're going to answer. Okay? So redemption means value. To be redeemed means an incredible sense that the nature of being is valuable in and of itself because it is one with the greater reality, the greater self called God. And even if I'm a failure, I'm still valuable because I still am. And that's, of course, from the scientific point of view, that cannot be found in a laboratory, right? That cannot be found. The human body, when you boil it down, is worth 99 cents, I think, maybe it's less, in a laboratory, right? What is it worth? Functionally. But what is it worth existentially? It's just beyond. It's priceless. It's priceless. But this is why Rav Soloveitchik explains that it's in defeat. It's in defeat that one really encounters and faces their existential meaning. As long as I'm successful, and I'm fulfilling a certain important side of myself, a divine mandate to be godlike, to be in the image of a creator, I'm flying ahead. Right? But when does Adam 2 really come to the fore in those moments of utter devastation in terms of feeling? As an Adam 1, I begin to wonder, why do I still feel important? Why do I still feel my life is valuable? Some people don't and they give up their life, but that's the sad thing about it. Because this world has so invested in the Adam 1 venture and has so neglected the Adam 2 venture, which are two very important, valid ventures that we all need to pursue. Okay. So Adam 1 is created male and female simultaneously. He's a social creature because his dignity is based on being in a social context, being able to demonstrate in a behavioral way the ability to conquer, the ability to be in control of the environment. Now, Adam 1 and Adam 2 have a completely different understanding of community. Right? What is community then really all about? So here are some excerpts from Lonely Man of Faith about community, the community. Adam the first is challenged by a hostile environment and hence summoned to perform many tasks which he alone cannot master. You can't do it by yourself, Adam 1 realizes. If I want to conquer, I've got to group together. Consequently, he is impelled to take joint action. Helpless individuals, cognizant of difficulties they encounter when they are acting separately, congregate, make arrangements, enter into treaties of mutual assistance, sign contracts, form partnerships. Adam 1 is a businessman. He's a corporate man. He understands that the way you succeed is by mergers. That's what it's all about. You know? Merging together because you can help me and I can help you and together we will conquer this world. The natural community is born of a feeling of individual helplessness. The community for Adam 1 is a natural community. Soloveitchik explains why is it natural. He says because animals do the same thing. When animals feel that they're being threatened, they congregate together. They herd together as an act of survival. And so too, it's natural. There's a certain naturalness to community for the human being. Since his mandate is to succeed and to achieve and to conquer, and he realizes that as an individual he will not be able to succeed as well, in his best interests, not in the best interests of the community, but the community is seen in a very useful way to get to where I've got to go. You follow? All right? And these are the people I know, and these are my business colleagues, And that's very important for me to achieve the dignity I'm achieving. The natural community is born of a feeling of individual helplessness. Whenever Adam the First wants to work, to produce, to succeed in this undertaking, he must unite with others. And that's it. You form a union so that you can achieve. If the individual is ontologically complete, even perfect, this is a, I'll get to it in a second, that Robinson Crusoe, right, functionally was successful. He could have been more successful if there was someone there to help him, right? But he was okay successfully, right? And therefore, from his standpoint, I'm perfect. You know, I could have done it better if I had more people to help me, but basically I'm complete. From a functional point of view, I'm complete, and if there were more people, then I would have been more successful, but essentially, on a functional level, I'm not missing anything. So then he explains, but there's something that Robinson Crusoe would be missing, right? And this is what he explains. If the individual is ontologically complete, even perfect, then the experience of loneliness must be alien to him, since loneliness is nothing but the act of questioning one's own ontological legitimacy, worth, and reasonableness. In other words, what is the difference between Adam 1 and Adam 2? Adam 1 is never alone. He was born and she was born at the same moment. Adam 1, man and woman, are never alone. And they're functionally fine because they have that partnership which produces and achieves. But Adam 2 is alone. But Adam 2 isn't alone, I'm sorry. Adam 2 is lonely. When God says it's not good that the man is levad, levado, it doesn't mean it's not good that the man is alone. Because if he's alone, he'll still in some limited way function. He won't reach the highest level, but he'll be able to function. Adam 1 can function alone. But Adam 2 cannot function alone because he's lonely. Why is he lonely? What makes him lonely? So he explains loneliness. This is a definition of loneliness. The act of questioning one's ontological legitimacy, worth, and reasonableness. In other words, I stop and I envision what would happen if I were to lose all of this. I would lose my business. I would lose all my property. All my social buddies would stop talking to me. Right? All my colleagues, partners, would walk away. And there I am. There I am. And I ask myself, regardless of what I do, is my existence legitimate? Is there value to my existence? Adam 1 justifies his existence by doing. Adam 2 asks himself, if I do nothing and I just am, is it reasonable that I should have a feeling of worthiness? And why does he even ask that question? Because he anticipates the answer is yes, because a spark of the divine is within. In fact, according to the biblical story, God was not concerned with the loneliness of Adam the First. Neither was Adam aware of the pronouncement, it's not good that man is alone, it's not good for man to be lonely. Moreover, the connotation of these words in the context of the worldview of Adam the First, even if they had been addressed to him, would have been related to not to loneliness, an existential in-depth experience, but to aloneness, a practical surface experience. In other words, if you were to say to Adam 1, it's not good that man is alone, what would he say? You're right, I can't succeed as well if I don't have a partner. Right? And it's better 2 than 1, because if one falls down, the other will pick him up and we'll keep running. Okay? That's how Adam 1 would interpret that verse. But that verse wasn't even applied to Adam 1, because that's not a situation. Right? Because Adam 1 could succeed alone, to a limited extent anyways. But Adam 2, he's faced with loneliness. And why is he faced with loneliness? That's a very deep idea. You see, if you have the spark of the divine within you, then what you essentially have is a spark of absolute uniqueness. And everybody senses absolute uniqueness. Everybody senses a certain loneliness because nobody is a duplicate of me. Nobody can experience my pain. They can maybe try and share it. They can maybe talk to me. But still, I face my pain as a single individual. You and I are not the same. You cannot duplicate me. You can try and understand me based on your experiences, but that still won't be understanding me. And therefore, I can't help but feel a certain, in a deep, deep way, a certain loneliness. Whereby the way I see the world and feel the world, and the pains and the joys and the struggles, are uniquely mine because I am experiencing them and you are not. You might want to talk to me about it. You might share it, but even when you experience it, it will be in a very unique and different way. And so there will be a place of total uniqueness. And therefore, that loneliness is very, very painful. And I have a million acquaintances, hundreds of colleagues, running around the world, flying in my plane. I get off the plane, they roll out the red carpet, and everyone's there to meet me. Everybody knows my name, but nobody knows the real me. And so, Adam first, representing the natural community, would translate... Let's go on. Go to the words, "I shall make him a helpmate," would refer in accordance with his social philosophy, meaning Adam 1, to a functional partner to whom it would be assigned to collaborate with and assist Adam, the first, his undertaking schemes and projects. That's what a helpmate would mean for Adam 1, a partner. Eve vis-a-vis Adam first would be a work partner, not an existential co-participant. Big words, but I tell you, important ideas. Are you looking for a partner or are you looking for an existential co-participant? Are you looking for somebody that you can work with and build a home with? Or are you looking for someone that you can cry in their presence? Are you looking for someone that you believe that in your greatest, most devastating moments of defeat, you are not afraid that they will turn away from you, but they will still acknowledge you because you are a spark of the divine. And that's what you're looking for, an existential co-participant. Man alone cannot succeed, says Adam the first, because a successful life is possible only within a communal framework. So, man, one, needs a community, not from an existential point of view, from a functional point of view. And if that community wasn't there, okay, so it wouldn't function as great. Right? But Adam, too, needs community for a completely different reason. And this is the kind of community that people, unfortunately, are not experiencing. But in Jerusalem, and I have found a Torah community, that's what you can find such a thing. The natural commune of Adam the first enhances man's chances for successful survival, yet does not elevate or enhance his existential experience, since the latter is in no need of redemption or catharsis. Right? He's not feeling lonely. He's not looking for someone to just say, "I'm lonely," and have that person not give you an answer, but simply listen and nod and put their arm around you. Someone that you can turn to and say, "I have failed." And that person nonetheless will still value you. Adam, the one, doesn't look for cathartic experiences of relieving his emotional pain of loneliness, relieve the need to be acknowledged existentially. Adam the first feels safer and more comfortable in the company of Eve in a practical, not ontological way. I need this mate practically. He will never admit that he cannot ontologically see himself without Eve. Do you hear this? Right? I can work, but not as well. But Adam too says, "I can't even exist without you. I can't exist if I'm lonely. I can produce, if I'm alone, but I cannot exist if I'm lonely. I need you to be by my side. Even if you say nothing. Even if you have no answers for my problems. I don't expect answers to my problems. The fact that I even feel a problem is very satisfying, because it tells me inside I feel that my existence is meaningful. And if it wasn't meaningful, there'd be no problems, nothing to worry about. They, Adam and Eve, act together, work together, pursue common objectives together, yet they do not exist together. What a powerful thing, I tell you. And you've seen marriages, I'm sure, like that. People work together, they built together. They don't exist together. They share the same bed. They do not share the same soul. Ontologically, they do not belong to each other. Each is provided with an I awareness and knows nothing of a we awareness. Adam 1 is a man and a woman created concurrently, and there's nothing that apparently enjoins them existentially. Right? But functionally, they work together to conquer the world. They've been both asked to conquer this world, so to speak, as a working couple. But Adam 2, he needs to first be born without a partner. Adam 2 is a being that must first face the existential question. Looking at those animals, naming all those animals, he realizes how different he is, how incompatible he is, how when he looks in their eyes, there's nothing in their eyes when they look back at him. But when you look in the eyes of someone that you love, what are you looking for? Can you imagine two people staring at each other in such a romantic moment, someone saying, what are they doing? What are they doing? They're existing together. And if you feel uncomfortable doing that, you've missed. We get together to talk. Talk about what we're going to do in order that we can accomplish. No, we get together to be together. Togetherness for the sake of togetherness is existentially redeeming. I feel redeemed when you're beside me and existing. I feel dignified when you're beside me and working with me. And so Adam 1 is created without this spouse and is forced to deal with his existential meaning. He could have found an animal that could functionally be fine, but that animal could not give back that warm look. And that's the sad thing. Ontologically, they do not belong to each other. Each is provided with an I awareness, nothing of a we awareness. Of course, they communicate with each other, but the communication lines are open between two surface personalities engaged in work, dedicated to success and speaking cliches and stereotypes, and not between two souls bound together in an indissoluble relationship, each one speaking in unique laga. The in-depth personality do not communicate, let alone commune with each other. On the surface, we're talking inside. Nothing's happening. And God blessed them, and God said to them, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth, and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the fowl of the earth, and over every creepy thing. Male and female were summoned by their Creator to act in unison, in order to act successfully. Yet they were not charged with the task of existing in unison, in order to cleanse, redeem, and hallow their existence. And those are three important words. Because the problem people have when they come to Torah like Adam 1 people. Functionally, technologically. I remember one student saying to me, if the rabbis were so smart, why did they create a Walkman? You know, it sounds like a silly question. It is a silly question. But it comes from the fact that he values the mandate of the human being has come to create Walkmans, technology. But the rabbis and Torah didn't really come for the Adam 1 venture. Adam 1 will discover that scientifically. But Torah comes to address the Adam 2 issues. The meaning of life. The value of life. The quality of life rather than the quantity of life. Torah is about a community whereby I'm not in this community because we work better together. But I'm in this community because we exist and our existence redeems each other. We share ourselves with each other. We're not here for a business meeting. We're not here to talk strategy. we hear so our hearts will pulse together, and that we will encourage each other and remind each other and share our loneliness and realize that our loneliness comes from a wonderful place. It comes from such incredible value, such incredible uniqueness. And then I feel redeemed from my loneliness. So Adam 1 is never alone. Adam 2 must discover what it means to be lonely, so that he addresses and that he challenges not his functional worth, but he challenges his existential worth, his inner worth. And if I were to fail functionally, would I still be valuable and legitimately existing just by virtue that I am? God has created me with the breath of his I am-ness within. And mankind is not redeemed until we discover that.
This presentation by Rabbi David Aaron has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.